No one spoke for a long, tense tick of time. Now, does that phenomenon suggest anything of note to anyone?
If the building is a nexus point of geomagnetic energy, then it could have been a release, a venting of sorts.
I concur. Whether it releases the energy as a wave or intermittent bursts, there's no way we can know.
Just like if the venting is controlled, or a natural event, like a geyser.
If it's powerful enough to blind our satellite, it sure as hell could blank out the transponder signals.
That would be my guess as well. It's the logical conclusion.
Could it have the same qualities as a dampening field?
Possibly. But geomancy is the manipulation of constant Earth energies. I don't perceive a way they could be used to generate a field that inhibits the transformation of energy. The variable factors to create and maintain such a field would be too...
Variable?
Exactly. It's remotely possible that the geomagnetic field is generated at will, but I tend to doubt that's the case. If, on the outside chance it is, the potential for a truly dreadful weapon is locked up within the ancient kingdom of the Khmers.
There's a matter we're going to have to settle first. The means of actually getting to the ancient kingdom of the Khmers. We only have the one TAV here at present, and the jump seat we installed is barely big enough for Domi, let alone a full-grown man. And only me and Kane are rated to fly the thing.
Lakesh turned in his chair, regarding Grant appraisingly.
What do you suggest, friend Grant?
The big man lifted the broad yoke of his shoulders in a shrug and pointed to Kane, then tapped his chest with a thumb.
Me and Kane draw straws about who goes and who stays. It's the only fair way to do it.
Would the winner get to go or get to stay here?
Grant's lips quirked in a rueful smile beneath his mustache.
Well, now I suppose that's something else we're going to have to settle, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
The flight went smoothly until Kane made his second flyover of the Angkor plane. Then the Manta began to have trouble. The journey from Montana, at slightly under the transatmospheric vehicle's maximum cruising speed of Mach 25, had been uneventful, boring even. Once the destination coordinates were input into the onboard navigational computer and the GPS lock achieved with the COMSAT, Kane did little more than watch as the vast blue tapestry of the Pacific Ocean blurred by so quickly, waves and islands became mere patterns of contrasting texture and color. At an altitude of 30,000 feet, Kane wasn't too concerned with accidentally overshooting his objective or colliding with another aircraft. Because of the 250-mile-per-hour winds that once swept regularly over the rad-ravaged face of America, aerial travel had been very slow to make a comeback. Unpredictable geothermals in the hell zones and chem storms had quadrupled the hazards of flying. Even the Deathbird gunships in use by the MAG divisions had only been pressed into service 30 or so years ago. The TAV, although sheathed in bronze-hued metal, held the general shape and configuration of a seagoing manta ray. It was little more than a flattened wedge with wings. Intricate geometric designs covered almost the entire exterior surface. Deeply inscribed into the hull were interlocking swirling glyphs, cup and spiral symbols, and even elaborate cuneiform markings. The composition of the hull, although it appeared to be of a burnished bronze alloy, was a material far tougher and more resilient. The craft had no external apparatus at all, no ailerons, no fins, and no airfoils. The cockpit was almost invisible, little more than an elongated symmetrical oval hump in the exact center of the sleek topside fuselage. The Manta's wingspan measured out to 20 yards, and the fuselage was around 15 feet long. A short tail assembly was tipped by an ace of spades-shaped rudder. A small fleet of the transatmospheric craft had been found on the Menetius moon base. Of Anunnaki manufacture, they were in pristine condition despite their great age. Powered by two different kinds of engines, a ramjet and solid-fuel pulse detonation air spikes, the Manta ships could fly in a vacuum and in an atmosphere. The Manta transatmospheric vehicle wasn't an experimental craft, but an example of a technology that was mastered by a race when humanity still cowered in trees from saber-toothed tigers. Grant and Kane had easily learned to pilot the ships, since they handled superficially like the Deathbirds the two men had flown when they were Cobaltville magistrates. But they learned that when they were flying in space, the Mantas did not handle like winged aircraft within an atmosphere. A pilot could select velocity, angle, attitude, and other complex factors dictated by standard avionics, but spaceflight relied on a completely different set of principles. It called for the maximum manipulation of gravity, trajectory, relative velocities, and plain old luck. Despite all the computer-calculated course programming, both men discovered quickly that successfully piloting the TAV through space was more by God than by grace. Skill had almost nothing to do with it. Kane wore a bronze-colored helmet with a full-face visor, the helmet itself attached to the headrest of the pilot's chair. A pair of tubes stretched from the rear to an oxygen tank at the back of the ejection seat. The helmet and chair were of one piece, a self-contained unit. The instrument panel was almost shocking in its simplicity. The controls consisted primarily of a joystick, altimeter, and fuel gauges. All the labeling was in English. But the interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with CGI icons of sensor scopes, rangefinders, and various indicators. All the HUD icons and indicators showed green, and so Kane had plenty of time to think and to worry. He couldn't help but smile in recollection of his last sight of Grant, standing out on the improvised launch pad as the Manta lifted off at shortly before midnight, propelled upward by the vectored thrust ramjets. Grant had been bellowing profanities, first into the grit-laden backwash kicked up by the thrusters, then into a handheld transcom unit. His voice, transmitted into the confines of Kane's helmet, was the deafening roar of an outraged lion.
"You tricky bastard! You drew the short straw! You lost!"
"Oh, I'm sorry. I was confused. I thought if I lost, that meant I had to go."
"You know damn well what the deal was. Get back down here."
Kane glanced down and saw Domi struggling over the embankment to join Grant. She had her Detonics Combat Master in her right hand. He engaged the pulse detonation engines, and the Manta hurled across the sky like an artillery shell. Whatever else Grant had to say was swallowed up by the sonic boom. Within seconds, the TAV was out of the transcom's range. Kane didn't feel too badly about tricking his partner and Domi. He easily imagined the type of obscene and imaginative vituperation the girl spat out. But he knew he would feel a lot worse if something happened to either one of them on the op, leaving him to break the news to Lakesh or Shizuka. He would miss their presence, regardless, particularly that of Grant. When two men worked together for as long as they had, often balancing on the knife edge between life and death, they relied on each other implicitly. Without Grant along, Kane felt distinctly like a trapeze artist performing dangerous stunts without a net. But unlike him, Grant had not chosen the life of an exile, an insurrectionist. He had sacrificed everything that gave his life a degree of sense to help Kane and Bridget escape from Cobaltville. Even after all the time that had elapsed since that day, which felt like a very long time ago, Kane still felt responsible for what the man had given up and what he had suffered since then in the war against the hybrid barons. But old habits died very hard. Kane and Grant had been partners for nearly 15 years, and it was part and parcel of Magistrate Division conditioning to always back a partner's play. The Magistrate Divisions were formed as a complex police machine that demanded instant obedience to its edicts, and to which there was no possible protest. Magistrates were a highly conservative, duty-bound group. The customs of enforcing the law and obeying orders were ingrained almost from birth. The magistrates submitted themselves to a grim and unyielding discipline because they believed it was necessary to reverse the flood tide of chaos and restore order to post-Holocaust America. As magistrates, the courses their lives followed had been charted before their births. They had exchanged personal hopes, dreams, and desires for a life of service. They were destined to live, fight, and die, usually violently. All magistrates followed a patrilineal tradition, assuming the duties and positions of their fathers. They didn't have given names, each taking the surname of the father, as though the first magistrate to bear the name were the same man as the last. The originators of the magistrate divisions had believed that only surnames, family names, engendered a sense of obligation to the duties of their ancestors' office, ensuring that subsequent generations never lost touch with their hereditary roles as enforcers. Last names became badges of social distinction, almost titles. Over the past 90 years, both the oligarchy of barons and the mags who served them had taken on a fearful, almost legendary aspect. For most of their adult lives, both Kane and Grant had been part of that legend, cogs in a merciless machine. They had been through the dehumanizing cruelty of magistrate training, yet they had somehow, almost miraculously, managed to retain their humanity. Now, for the past 2 years, they had exercised their humanity by doing their very best to not just dismantle the machine, but to utterly destroy it and scatter the pieces to the four corners of the world. They had devoted themselves to the work of Cerberus. But the situation in Cerberus had changed dramatically over the past couple of months, particularly after the arrival of the Menetius-based personnel and the pregnant hybrid woman, Quavel. If Quavel really did carry Cain's child, then the entire dynamic of the struggle against the tyranny of the Barons had changed. The Barons, the hybridized god-kings who had inherited Earth from their human cousins, whom they scorned as ape-kin, actually represented the final phase of human evolution. They referred to themselves as new humans and empowered themselves to control not only their immediate environment, but also the evolution of other species. The Barons did so by planning and creating wholesale alterations in living organisms, changing evolutionary patterns to suit themselves. They considered the pinnacle of evolutionary achievement was themselves, the Barons, as high above ordinary hybrids, who were bred as a servant class, as the hybrids were above mere humans. Despite how mad the entire tale of Archon-human hybrids seemed initially, Cain grew comfortable with it and eased into hating the hybrid dynasty and the baronial oligarchy. He woke up hating the hybrids and the Barons and went to bed hating the hybrids and the Barons. Then he learned his hatred was not only pointless, but also pretty much without basis. The Archons existed only as a fabricated cover story created 2 centuries before and expanded with each succeeding generation. It was all a ruse, bits of truth mixed in with outrageous fiction. Only a single so-called Archon existed on Earth, and that was Balaam, who had been the redoubt's resident prisoner for more than 3.5 years. Balaam claimed the Archon Directorate was an appellation created by the pre-Dark governments. Lakesh referred to it as the Oz effect, wherein a single vulnerable entity created the illusion of being the representative of an all-powerful body. Even more shocking than that revelation was Balaam's assertion that he and his folk were humans, not alien, but alienated. Cain still didn't know how much to believe. But if nothing else, he no longer subscribed to the fatalistic belief that the human race had had its day and only extinction lay ahead. Balaam had indicated that was not true, but was instead another control mechanism. New and old humans would have to learn to share the planet with each other if either group was to have a destiny. But even by crossbreeding with humanity, the hybrids were still markedly different from humankind. However, as Quavel pointed out, different was not the same as alien. She herself confessed that her own race viewed humans as savages, little more than bloodthirsty apes who were incapable of transcending their roots as killers. She had other experiences with humans as well, specifically with Cain. A mission to the Archuleta Mesa biomedical facility had inadvertently wiped out the genetic engineering division of the vast facility. What remained of the place, both in personnel and machinery, was transferred to the much larger Area 51 facility. The necessary equipment and raw material to implement procreation had yet to be installed. Baron Cobalt had unilaterally decided that the conventional means of conception was the only option to keep the hybrid race alive. Since the Baron held Cain responsible for pushing the hybrid race to the brink of extinction, he made it his task to repopulate it as well. Cain wasn't the first human male to be pressed into service. There had been other men before him, but they had performed unsatisfactorily due to their terror of the hybrids. Cain's sense of surprise was still fresh when he recollected how Quavel, during one of their scheduled periods of copulation, confided to him that not every hybrid agreed with the baronial policy toward humanity. He was even more surprised when she helped him and Domi escape. Both of them were forced to reassess everything they thought they knew about the Barons, about the hybrids. After Quavel's arrival at Cerberus, she revealed that she had made the long overland trip from Area 51 in a stolen sandcat, all alone. She traveled as far as the foothills of the Bitterroot Range to the encampment of Skydog. The shaman brought her the rest of the way to the mountain peak on horseback. Both Cain and Lakesh were still skeptical of certain details of her story, particularly how she knew the location of the redoubt. She offered only a vague explanation about learning of it from either Kane or Domi during their period of imprisonment in Dreamland. She had refused to name which one of them actually made the revelation. Neither Kane nor Domi admitted to telling her or anyone else about Cerberus. Still, Quivel had provided them with information about the current state of the baronies following the Imperator War, although few details could be confirmed. Quivel's presence in the redoubt made Kane distinctly uncomfortable, since the entire situation evoked unpleasant memories of Lakesh's abortive plan to turn Cerberus from a sanctuary to a colony. To that end, babies needed to be born, children with superior genetic traits. Making a unilateral decision, Lakesh arranged for a woman named Beth Lee Rauch to be brought into the redoubt from one of the baronies to mate with Kane, thus ensuring that his superior abilities were passed on to offspring. Without access to the techniques of fetal development outside the womb that were practiced in the Vills, the conventional means of procreation was the only option, and that meant sex and passion and the fury of a woman scorned. Kane had refused to cooperate for a variety of reasons, primarily because he felt the plan was a continuation of the sinister elements that had brought about the nuke cost and the tyranny of the Vills. His refusal had tragic consequences. Only a thirst for revenge and a conspiracy to murder had been birthed within the walls of the redoubt, not children. And now Beth Lee was dead, killed by Domi and buried in a simple grave out on the hillside. Kane could only pray Quavel's involvement in the lives of the Cerberus residents did not have equally tragic consequences. The countdown to her delivery date had begun. As far as he knew, by the time he returned to Cerberus, a newborn something might be waiting for him. The prospect didn't warm his blood. To distract himself from dwelling on the possibility, Kane tested the action of his Sin Eater, snugged in the power holster strapped to his right forearm. He raised his arm, bending it at the elbow. A tiny electric motor whined as he flexed his wrist tendons. Sensitive actuators activated flexible cables in the forearm holster and snapped the Sin Eater smoothly into his gloved hand. He repeated the maneuver several times until he was satisfied and grew bored. Folding his arms over his chest, he leaned as far back in the pilot's chair as he could, and after a bit of twisting and hitching around to find the most comfortable position, he managed to drift off. The blazing glory of dawn flamed in the sky as the Manta's navigational computers brought it on a direct trajectory across the white-capped waters of the South China Sea, then over Vietnam. Within minutes, the craft crossed over the border into Cambodia. Signaled by the GPS, the TAV automatically dropped its airspeed to 500 miles per hour. The change in speed roused Kane from a fitful slumber, and he came to full alertness. Swiftly, he oriented himself, then lowered the Manta's altitude to 300 feet and reduced the airspeed even further. As he did so, dawn became a fine, sunny morning. The terrain below looked interesting and rich. The TAV cruised over a seemingly limitless panorama of forested hills and wooded valleys. He glimpsed the mirrored surface of Tonle Sap, dancing with multicolored highlights. Tinted by the early morning sunshine, suffused by streamers of mist curling up from the tree line, the Cambodian jungle looked like an Eden. But he already knew the jungle held nasty surprises. Remembering the half-glimpsed figures from the satellite transmission, he cut in the low-power gravity modifier field, effectively silencing the engines. The rainforest fell away, and he skimmed over rich grasslands. He saw a collection of bamboo houses and tilled fields, all laid out precisely as an estate garden. Although he didn't see anyone, he figured farmers would be rising very soon. Touching the low observability camouflage switch on the control console, an electrical impulse fed through circuitry all over the hull of the Manta. Ambient waves shifted over the bronze colors of the exterior, coating it as if with a film of ink. Within seconds, the TAV was the hue of the early morning sky, melting indistinguishably with it. Below him stretched a vista of huge reservoirs, irrigation canals, and a series of moats and other waterworks. At first glance, their engineering was almost on the level of the architecture of the buildings rising from the plain. Kane decided to move in very slowly and circle Angkor Thom. He initiated the telemetric sensor, hoping to detect a signal from the transponders carried by the three missing people. The instrument registered nothing. He lifted the Manta to 1,000 feet, cut the ramjet thrusters, coasted in on the gravity modifiers. Putting the TAV into a hover position, he looked down. Seeming to float in the air between his eyes and the visor, a column of numbers appeared, glowing red against the pale bronze. When he focused on a distant object, the visor magnified it and provided a readout as to distance and dimension. The huge, multi-towered temple Lakesh had identified as Angkor Wat glistened with early morning dew, but there was no sign of movement anywhere. For a moment, Kane had the impression he was looking down upon a gargantuan alien cemetery, as strange as the citadel of Enki he had seen on the moon. According to Lakesh, a number of the megalithic structures had served as tombs of the Khmer rulers, so it was possible that Angkor Thom was nothing but a miles-long mausoleum. He completed the first pass over the city and was just beginning the second when his point man sense kicked in. He experienced an intense sensation of uneasiness, of apprehension. He looked down and saw the tapered tips of the Angkor Wat towers seeming to shine, becoming almost luminescent. At first, he attributed the light to a dewy reflection of the early morning sun. Then the HUD thermometer icon began flashing. As he looked at it in amazement, the temperature climbed rapidly, first degree by degree, then in multiple jumps. At the same time, several of the other icons winked out. Kane didn't hesitate. He kicked in the ramjet's full throttle, not worrying about the noise. Acceleration slammed him hard against his chair. The Manta shot away from Angkor Thom like a rock launched from a catapult, hurtling in the general direction of Tonle Sap. At the moment, he didn't care about the heading of the TAV as long as it was away from the city. The engine roar skipped and faltered. The ship shuddered. Jockeying the port and starboard maneuvering jets, Kane sent the Manta skittering wildly, veering off on another course entirely. He jabbed a series of vent switches on the control panel, hoping that if he opened them, the influx of air would cool down the cockpit. They were all locked in place. The heat inside the Manta climbed to 150 degrees. If not for the internal thermostat of the shadow suit he wore and the oxygen provided by the helmet, he would have lost consciousness. He wasn't sure how many miles he put between him and the city when all the CGI icons on the inner curve of his helmet's visor faded away. The Manta began to lose altitude. Although he was loath to ditch, Kane reached for the ejector seat lever beneath the pilot's chair. He could come down by glider chute and find the TAV later to remove the supplies and ordnance in the storage compartment. He adjusted his harness and wrenched at the lever. Nothing happened. Kane braced himself and pulled again, but still nothing happened.
Oh, shit.
The Manta dropped fast in a dead-stick dive. The ship's wing configuration provided a certain amount of air resistance, but Kane wasn't at all sure it was sufficient to slow the craft's descent and keep it intact, or for him to survive the impact. The ship began to wobble, tipping up on its starboard wing, then on its port side as it plummeted down toward the jungle. Nausea churned in Kane's belly as he watched the horizon slide up and down. Suddenly, a couple of the HUD icons flickered and flashed back to life. He felt a surge of desperate exultation. Whatever had knocked out the Manta's power system apparently had a limited range. Not all of the ship's systems came back online, but Kane partly succeeded in stabilizing the Manta's attitude so it no longer wobbled. He could feel the vibrations of the powered-up stabilizers rattling through the deck at his feet. A queasy liquid sensation began in his stomach, and the shuddering that racked the TAV from stem to stern didn't help it any. The green mass of foliage still rushed up far too fast. With a sense of detachment that bemused even him, he wondered at his odds of survival. 2-1 against, he concluded, not too pessimistic since it left a margin of error. There was a possibility he would survive. He braced himself against his chair and tried to go limp. He recalled Philboyd mentioning that the Anunnaki had built the Mantas with at least three different kinds of shock absorbers. They had designed their ships to give the pilots the best chance of survival if the engines failed. The Manta skimmed over three palm trees, shearing off the tops as if it were a scythe. Flat, wide fronds slapped against the canopy and flattened themselves, effectively blocking Kane's line of sight. Not that there would have been much to see, he reminded himself sourly. The TAV hit the ground on its belly, bounced several times like a flat stone skipping across the surface of a pond, crashed through a wall of foliage and bulldozed its way over fallen logs, snapping saplings like matchwood. The wingtips dragged along snarled tangles of brush. Branches were stripped of leaves and trees of bark as the armored hull whipped past them. King's body strained against the recoil harness and then slammed back into the seat violently. All the air exploded from his lungs as he was engulfed in a thundering wave of shock, followed by pain. The Manta slithered along the damp ground like a downsliding boulder, leaving a wide, scoured path in its wake, turf rolling up before it like a strip of carpet. By the time the ship careened to a stop, Kane sagged unconscious in the straps. He floated back to consciousness like a waterlogged timber bobbing to the surface of a pond. The closer he came to awakening, the more aware he became of the pain and the tang of his own blood in his mouth. The temptation to drift back into the dark was strong, but he forced his eyes open. It took him a few seconds to focus, and when he did, he almost closed his eyes again. He looked up at a vision torn from the delirium of a lunatic. Double rows of needle-pointed teeth gleamed wetly from a saurian snout. Beady, snake-like eyes stared unblinkingly down at him. The scaled head was almost the size of that of a horse. Squeezing itself through the sprung-open cockpit canopy, its long, wet, forked tongue slithered in and out of its maw between upper and lower rows of yellowed fangs. Kane stared without comprehension at the reptilian head pushing its way into the cockpit, saliva dripping from its mottled tongue onto his faceplate. It took his stunned brain a moment to identify what his eyes were seeing, and his brain didn't like it one bit. Although he was wondering wildly if he were unconscious or asleep and just having a nightmare, he decided not to take the chance that either was the case. He flexed his right wrist tendons and the Sin Eater slid into his palm. The snapping reports of the shots brought Kane back to more or less full awareness, and he slowly took stock of his surroundings. The Manta had come to rest at an angle of about 30 degrees, and he was held in position only by his safety harness. The canopy was partially open, and he saw a patch of blue sky overhead between swaying palm fronds. Judging by the position of the sun, he figured it was mid-morning, so he had been unconscious more than an hour. His chest and back hurt abominably, but when he shifted position, nothing felt broken. He tasted blood because his teeth had cut into the tender inner lining of his lower lip. Reaching up, he touched the latch on the underside of the helmet to open the seal. With a hiss of air, he felt the pressure relax around the base of his neck, and he pushed the helmet up and back from his head. Teeth clenched on a groan, Kane hit the harness release, and he shrugged out of the straps. Slowly, his thought processes returned to normal, and he recovered his equilibrium. He thumbed a few switches on the console. Power lights glowed, wavered, died, glowed again, and then faded out completely. He swallowed a curse of frustration. Whatever kind of force exuded by the temple had acted like a bucket of water dashed onto a fire. A few embers still sputtered, but no flames could build until the fuel dried out. Carefully, Kane heaved himself upright and pushed open the canopy all the way. He struggled out, but because the Manta was canted at an angle, he fell from the wing and landed amid a bed of ferns. He would have lain there, suffering, except for the corpse of the giant lizard lying on the ground only a few inches away. Shoving himself to his feet, he staggered back and half fell against the hull of the ship, his heart pounding in sudden fear, Sin Eater aimed at the creature. Its maimed head lolled limply on the long scaled neck, which joined a barrel-bodied torso. Its four bowed legs looked almost too short for it, but the four-toed paws were tipped with hooked talons. Its belly was whitish, but the rest of the body was coated by an interlocking pebble pattern of gray-green scales, from tip of the snout to the long, muscular tail that stretched out of sight into the underbrush. He took a deep breath to calm himself, despite the pain in his chest. His stomach jumped in adrenaline-fueled spasms, even though he knew the monster was dead. Although he had always prided himself on being free of phobias, with a surge of shame he realized he had developed a fear of things reptilian over the past couple of years. It wasn't an irrational fear, but one derived from terrifying first-hand experience. First, there was his encounter with Lord Strongbow and his mutagenically altered Imperial Dragoons, with their scale-ringed, snakish eyes. Then there was his terrifying battle with a gigantic constrictor atop a ziggurat in South America. One of the natives had been decked out in a feathered headdress and christened Kukulkan in homage to the ancient Mayan god. That incident was followed only a short time later by walking a gauntlet of diamondbacks in California. His fear of things reptilian had reached its culmination a few months before during his nightmarish bareback ride on Monstradamus through the jungle of Thunder Isle. Within a few moments, he had calmed sufficiently to eye the creature a bit more clinically. He realized it was a large version of a monitor lizard, a species that had been called Komodo dragons in pre-dark days. He estimated this one to be at least 20 feet long and probably weighing in at 1,000 pounds. The mutant animals spawned in the aftermath of the nuke cost that tended toward gigantism were rare, Although he had encountered several oversized monsters since joining Cerberus, including a truck-sized snapping turtle. Still, a monitor lizard afflicted with polyploidism, a doubling of the chromosome count, which accounted for its unusual size, was nowhere near as terrifying as the Dasplitosaur he had christened Monstradamus. Kane pushed himself away from the manta and glanced around. In every direction, wherever he looked, he saw thick green foliage. Tangles of flowering creeper vines carpeted the jungle floor. The boles of huge trees stood like pillars all around, some of them showing fresh scars inflicted by the wings of the manta. Dozens of flying insects swirled in the air, a swarm of beautifully colored butterflies among them. The atmosphere was like that within a greenhouse, impregnated with the overwhelming odor of vegetation and heavy with humidity. The hot air lay on his face like the touch of soft, moist hands. His shadow suit kept him comfortable as the internal thermostats adjusted to the high temperature. He made a circuit of the manta, but found no major damage. Rather than wasting more time trying to start the ship, he decided to leave it where it was for the time being until he scouted out the surroundings. From a storage compartment in the undercarriage, he removed a backpack of emergency rations, a copperhead subgun, extra magazines for the weapon, and a small handheld PDA. He attached his 14-inch combat knife to the scabbard outside his right boot. From the backpack, he removed a bottle of analgesic tablets and washed down two of them with a swig of water from a canteen. In the pack were various painkillers and stimulants. He sat down in the shadow of the portside wing, and soon he began to feel better, the pain easing. Reaching up behind his head, he touched the contact, making sure the contact was still there. The tiny transceiver fit tightly against the mastoid bone behind his right ear. Implanted steel pintles embedded in the bones slid through the flesh and into tiny input ports in the small curves of metal. The contacts had been found in Redoubt Yankee and were described as state-of-the-art multiple-channel communication devices. Their sensor circuitry incorporated an analog-to-digital voice encoder that was embedded in the mastoid bone. The pintles connected to input ports in the comms themselves. Once they made contact, transmissions were picked up by the auditory canals and the dermal sensors transmitted the electronic signals directly through the cranial casing. Even if someone went deaf, as long as they wore a comtact, they would still have a form of hearing. The comtacts were still being field tested, since in order to make them operational, surgery was required and few people wanted to make that sacrifice. But the surgery to implant the sensors was very minor, with only a small incision behind the ear to slide them under the skin. The Comtact's 5-mile range was superior to that of the handheld transcoms. The range of the radiophones was generally limited to a mile, but in open country, in clear weather, contact could be established at 2 miles. Bridget and Phil Boyd had agreed to the surgery, but Nora Pennick had not. The Comtacts had other uses as well. In conjunction with a sophisticated translation program within the PDA, the Comtact analyzed the pattern of a language and then provided a real-time translation. Some foreign phrases and words would not be exact translations, but the program recognized enough words to supply an English equivalent. Conversely, the program would supply him the appropriate responses in the language it heard. Consulting the digital compass within the PDA, he looked up at the bright Asian sun and set off in what he hoped was the direction of Angkor Thom. High above him, 100 feet or more, giant palm fronds met to make a bright green roof over much of the jungle, tinting everything with an emerald hue. A profusion of huge butterflies, dozens of them, wheeled and glided overhead. Their fluttering wings were almost as broad as his hand and were painted with all the colors of nature's palette— scarlet, orange, yellow, white, and bright blue. They dodged and darted through the alternating stripes of dark shadows and shafts of greenish sunlight. Under other circumstances, Kane would have been enchanted by their beauty. Near and far, tropical birds called in screeches, clacks, and hoots. Within a few minutes, Kane crossed a trail, a narrow road that cut through the forest. It was old and well-used, worn deep in the mulchy jungle floor and beaten down to a smooth channel. It came from the southeast and looped through the undergrowth. He stood and stared at the path, glancing first in one direction and then the other, absently kneading his aching chest. The analgesics had dimmed the pain but hadn't completely smothered it. He heard a chittering above him, and he swung his head up. A sad-eyed monkey calmly watched him from a branch. Kane smiled dourly and saluted. The monkey yawned and turned away. Glancing at the compass again, he chose to turn right onto the road. He walked less than 100 yards when the road curved lazily to the right. From around the bend, he heard a faint, dry creaking sound. His nostrils caught the whiff of an odor he had smelled many times in his life, but never grown accustomed to. A prickling of dread began inching its way up his spine to settle in a cold knot at his nape. His scalp felt as if it was pulling taut. Something was wrong. He could sense it the way a seasoned wolf sensed a trap. Kane moved into the brush that flanked the path, working his way cautiously around the bend. On the far side of the road, he saw the trunk of a huge fig tree. A dead man hung crucified from it. Spread-eagled to a bamboo framework in the shape of an X, suspended by chains from a thick bough of a tree, the corpse was secured to the frame by spikes driven through his wrists and ankles. He had been hanging there for at least 2 days, perhaps longer. Birds, insects, and other carrion feeders had stripped his face almost of all flesh, so it was impossible to gauge the corpse's age. Although the corpse's clothes hung in tatters, Kane realized he wore the remains of a drab-green uniform. A placard hung from the man's neck. The swirling, curving letters were large and crudely wrought, and although he couldn't read the language, he guessed the legend was meant as a warning. He began walking again, more alert for sounds and signs of habitation than before. Before long, he came across a few. Footprints intersecting, brush trampled, stems of shrubbery broken. Bending to study the footprints, he estimated that at least 3 men had passed by, dragging a fourth, whose toes dragged in the dirt, digging narrow gouges. He guessed they were the same people who had crucified the dead man. Looking across the path, he saw an area where brush and tall ferns had been pushed aside to allow passage into the jungle. He didn't care to follow the trail, so he turned back down the road. He walked steadily for half an hour, when the path skirted the banks of a pond. Frogs croaked from the tall rushes sprouting from the water's edge. Kane eyed it, looking for indications that anyone had passed by recently, but he saw nothing except for what he took to be an animal trail to the water. Suddenly he received the sudden but no less distinct impression he was being watched. He glanced all around him, but could see nothing but foliage. He started walking again, but now he felt claustrophobic beneath the green umbrella of the rainforest. The croaking of frogs abruptly ceased. A rustling commenced in the line of reeds bordering the pond. Kane stopped, his sin-eater springing into his hand, but the noise stopped almost instantly. He waited to hear it again. He began to sweat, despite the internal thermostat of the shadow suit. When the sound was not repeated, he marched forward again, the sense of being observed persisting. At the very edges of audibility, he heard the swishing sounds of plants being pushed aside. He stopped again, and so did the noise. Kane considered firing a 360-degree full-auto burst, but decided it was not tactically or diplomatically sound. On impulse, he decided to try an experiment. He kicked himself into a flat-out sprint, running down the road as fast as he could. With the possible exception of Domi, he was the fleetest of foot of everyone in Cerberus. He ran for the count of 20, ignoring the pain the exertions brought back to his chest. He came to a halt and tried to soften the harshness of his breathing as he stood still and listened. He definitely heard the crash of undergrowth behind him, although it ceased within seconds of him stopping. He stared into the brush, recovering his breath, waiting for the ache in his chest to subside. His imagination populated the undergrowth-screened jungle with all varieties of monster, far more fearsome than a giant monitor lizard. But neither a lizard nor any other variety of monster showed itself, so he opened his pack and took out the canteen. He tilted his head back as he drank, admiring the way shafts of sunlight pierced the canopy of the rainforest. He liked the contrast of pale yellow against the dark green. He was still aware of the sensation of being watched, but he wasn't too concerned anymore. Running himself ragged to outdistance an unseen observer fit his definition of the law of diminishing returns. When Kane lowered the canteen, he caught only a glimpse of the shadowy figure standing on the edge of the road before he spat out the last mouthful of water in a spray. He clutched at his copperhead, trying to bring it to bear.
If you seek a young woman, I can tell you where you might find her.
A small, bent man spoke to Kane from the brush line. He wore an olive-drab tunic laced with rawhide strings, homespun shorts, and leather sandals. His black hair was long and unkempt, speckled with gray. Three of his lower front teeth were missing. The man's wrinkle-netted face was impassive, having much the same color and texture as his sandals. Kane assumed his eyes were jet black, but it was hard to tell, since all he could see were slightly curved slits surrounded by baggy flesh. He looked to be about 5.5 feet tall, but because he was bent in an apparently perpetual crouch, he looked still smaller. The man's voice reverberated within Kane's head, first as a conglomeration of liquid syllables, before the translation program from the PDA fed him the English equivalent through the contact.
"You are an outlander, as was the girl."
Kane, keeping his copperhead trained on the man as he capped the canteen, looked behind him. He didn't see anyone else lurking in the brush.
"You saw a girl?"
"Oh, yes. Saw her as clear as I'm seeing you now. Very pretty girl, very spirited. Yes, a very pretty girl with wavy dark hair. Too pretty for these parts."
"Did you see anyone else with her?"
"What do you mean?"
"Was there a man and another woman with her? A woman whose hair was like sunset?"
He surprised himself with his poetic turn of phrase. He hoped it translated accurately. The little man shook his head.
"No, I only saw the dark-haired pretty girl. Too pretty for her own good she was."
"You keep saying that. What are you talking about?"
"She caught the general's eye. He's always interested in pretty young girls."
"The general of what?"
"The general. Warlord of these territories. Soon he will rule all the Vanquor Dome."
"How long ago did the general take her?"
4 days, I think."
"How far to Angkor Thom?"
"Nearly 50 miles, but she is not there."
Kane stepped forward, jaw muscles bunched as he struggled to tamp down his rising temper.
"Then where the hell is she?"
"Like I said, the general has her. If you would go to him, I can show the best route to take. My name is Cho Chan, and I can serve you as a guide."
Kane scowled at him.
"That's very convenient. Do you expect me to believe that you just hang around out here in the jungle, waiting for outlanders to pass by so you can guide them to places of interest?"
"No, outlander. I do not expect you to believe that. I was here to see the body of my son and pay my respects."
"Why didn't you cut him down?"
"And end my own life by hanging from one of these trees? No, outlander. My life is hard, but I do not wish for the Cobra Guard to relieve me of it in the same fashion they did my son's."
Kane didn't like the implications of the Cobra Guard, but he didn't respond to it.
"All right. I accept your offer."
"My usual fee is 5 quills a day."
"I don't have any of your local currency."
Cho Chan eyed the pack slung from Kane's shoulder.
"Perhaps you have some goods, some objects of value from your own land that could be traded. There's a trading post not far from here which you might exchange some items for quills."
"How far is it to this general of yours?"
"If we start now, we can make the trading post in less than an hour. Once I have my quills, we will reach the general very quickly."
Kane studied the man's wrinkled face for a moment, looking for signs of deception. He found none, but then he found nothing at all there but creases and seams. Cho Chan possessed a perfect poker face.
"All right, let's go get some quills."
Despite the occasional sour aspersions cast by Bridget Baptiste, Kane was not a fool, nor did he believe in coincidence. He didn't trust Cho Chan any further than he could have carried Grant piggyback, which wasn't far. The little man had not evinced much surprise at encountering a foreign stranger in the jungle, much less one dressed as oddly as Kane. Although he didn't think Cho Chan had been deliberately lurking near the road waiting for his arrival, he definitely suspected he had been lying in wait for someone. More than likely, the man was a spy or a scout for a party of brigands. After several minutes of marching down the green-shadowed tunnel formed by the intertwined boughs of trees overhanging the road, Kane noticed the cover lightening somewhat.
"Is there a river up ahead?"
"Yes, the Siem Reap. It is one of the many waterways that feeds the city of Angkor Thom."
"You've been there?"
"Of course."
"What do you know about it?"
"What everyone knows."
"Which is?"
"Ah, the ruler of Angkor Thom was originally a Naga princess called Ye Liu. There was then a foreigner called Khaun Dinya who practiced the cult of spirits. He dreamed that a spirit gave him a bow and then ordered him to board a trading vessel and take to sea. That evening, Caudinia returned to the spirit temple, where he found a bow and then, following the merchants, embarked upon the seas. He arrived at the town of Funan. Ye Liu led her troops to resist him. Caudinia raised his bow. Ye Liu took fright and submitted to him. Thereupon, Caudinia took her to wife and took her kingdom. Of course, that was a very long time ago.
Of course. I was thinking of something a little more recent. What I want to know is who rules there now.
Kumudvati, the Naga princess, direct descendant of the original Kumudvati, who married Kusha, the son of the great god Rama. It was part of a pact, you see, to end centuries of unremitting warfare. A human tribe known as Maunea were fighting with the Naga in the subterranean regions, whose dominions they seized and whose treasures they plundered. The Naga chiefs appeared to Vishnu for relief, and he instructed them in what to do. The Naga sent one of their princesses to the Maunea's king, Pariksit. She cursed him to die within 7 days as a result of a snake bite. The king decided to accept the curse as a will of providence and sat down at the bank of the Mekong to prepare for his death. At that time, the great young sage Shuka, the son of Vyasa, arrived there, and the king asked him to explain the most important knowledge meant for a person about to die. Thus, the sage started to narrate the great Purana. As a result, the king attained self-realization before he died.
Cain stopped short of sighing wearily. He forced himself to listen as he and Cho Chan tramped on down the trail, hoping he would eventually hear something of use.
But the king's son, Dharmajaya, became angry at the serpents, and to avenge his father's death, he started a great sacrifice meant to destroy all the serpents and the Naga. But later he stopped it to please the sage Astika, their relative. You see, Astika's father was the sage Jarakaru, who married Kumudvati, the sister of the Naga king Vasuki, who married Rama, who blessed Angkor Dome.
What the hell was the point of that story?
You'll find out soon.
Not if I can help it. Can't I just follow the river to Angkor Thom?
The little man flashed him a gap-toothed grin.
Do not fear, Outlander. I will make sure you reach your destination one way or another. You're very lucky that I encountered you. The forest is not kind to strangers.
I kind of got that impression when I came across your son.
Cho Chan's grin vanished, and he said nothing more for the next few minutes. The road dog-legged to parallel the muddy bank of the Siem Reap River. Brown water swirled and foamed around the buttressing roots of colossal trees that rose from the shallows like pillars.
Am I to understand this trading post of yours is on the river?
Cho Chan nodded.
That makes it easier to reach for villagers who live downriver.
A sudden thrashing in the undergrowth ahead of them brought the little man to a halt. He gestured for Cain to do the same.
There is a dragon stalking us.
How can you be sure?
The little man's splayed nostrils dilated.
I smell it.
Cain took a tentative whiff of the air and detected the faint, musky reek of reptiles.
I think you're right. Let's find a place to hide or defend ourselves.
The rest of his words were drowned out by a snapping and rending of bushes and saplings. Palm fronds and leaves scattered with a crash as the scaled monstrosity came blundering onto the road, its long tail lashing, whipping up loose twigs. With lumbering steps of its four squat legs, the giant lizard crept forward to block their path. Cain realized the dragon was smaller than the one he had killed earlier, but not by much. Its whitish belly nearly dragged on the ground, but the height of its head was almost the same as Cho Chan's. Tamping down the panic that threatened to consume him, Cain unleathered his sin-eater and raised the copperhead. Cho Chan took several unsteady steps backward.
We can try to run, but I am not very fast.
Cain carefully stepped around him, putting his body between the little man's and that of the giant monitor lizard.
I don't feel much like running. Feel free to go if you want.
The little man cast Cain a frightened look, then turned on his heel and began sprinting. As Cain hoped, the dragon lunged straight for the bent little man, its jaws gaping open and revealing needle-pointed fangs and a huge split tongue lolling in its mouth. The giant lizard went into thrashing convulsions, writhing and rolling through brush, crashing headlong into a tree trunk. Kane watched as its huge body spasmed wildly, its claws tearing up great clots of earth and its whiplashing tail shredding the undergrowth. The monster reptile flipped and flopped and struggled crazily, as if its brain refused to admit that its body was dying. Rolling over and over, it crushed a bed of ferns, then fell into the river with a great splash, the heavy flailing tails and spuming sheets of water cascading over the bank. The dragon's violent death throes slowly ceased, although its tail continued to twitch with post-mortem spasms. Crimson-tinged ripples spread out from its body. Cho-Chan gingerly returned to stand beside Kane.
You have powerful weapons, Outlander. You would be wise to conceal them if you traveled to Angkor Thom. To be caught with such weapons by the Cobra Guard would mean certain death.
I wouldn't die alone.
Oh, you needn't fear that I would betray you to them. I would not betray an enemy to those pigs, much less a man who just saved my life.
Good. Somebody else who claims they owe me big.
Outlander, I do not understand.
I didn't expect you to, but I do expect you to stop calling me Outlander. It has unpleasant associations for me. My name is Kane.
Very well. Kane.
Yes, very well. Is there any other carnivorous wildlife I should know about before we go on?
Yes, tigers.
Tigers? Big ones?
Oh, yes, very big tigers indeed, with very big appetites. So we should hurry before one of them smells the dragon's blood and comes to feast and decides we might make a good dessert.
Giant lizards, tigers, and warlords. Oh, my.
Bridget Baptiste had been taken prisoner too often over the past couple of years to delude herself into thinking that by lodging complaints with her captor, she would receive better treatment. As it was, she had been dealt with much more humanely by the self-proclaimed magickers than by most of her prior abductors. With her back pressed against a damp stone wall, her wrists and ankles were bound to pitons driven deep into the floor and wall. Multiple strands of leather thongs were drawn through eye bolts in all three pitons and expertly twisted and knotted around her extremities. Several yards across the dark gallery, a small fire burned in a bowl-shaped brazier, sending sooty smoke curling up to vanish in the dense gloom. Seated around the fire were three lean men wearing hooded, cassock-like robes and sandals. Despite their Asian features, they reminded her of pics she had seen of Franciscan monks, but after 3 days in their company, she knew they weren't holy men. The surreptitious glances they flicked up and down her figure, as tightly encased as it was in the black shadow suit, were anything but pious. All were bald, with heads so closely shaved no stubble was evident on their scalps. Their skins were a pale saffron hue, their eyes dark, and for the most part their faces were expressionless. The men all appeared to be identical at first, but after a couple of days, Bridget discerned differences among them, primarily due to their ages. Each bore upon his brow a symbol worked in metallic ink, that of a spiral surrounding a starburst. The spirals were of all the same cobalt blue, but the starbursts varied as to hue, red, yellow, and white. The magickers acted as her warders, but she learned almost nothing of them except they employed the honorific brother when they addressed one another in the Khmer dialect. Despite her eidetic memory, Bridget retained very few solid recollections of how she came to be in their custody. All she could call forth in her mind were dazed and chaotic visions, the staccato hammering of autofire, voices shouting words in a strange tongue, fleeting glimpses of rushing figures, Nora Penick's loud scream of terror, then a fragmented image of Brewster Filboid falling down, blood streaming over his face. A blow on the back of her head had detonated a bomb of stars within her skull. She vaguely remembered a sensation of falling, but not of landing. She had plunged into a sunless gulf of unconsciousness. When she awoke, she found herself securely bound, her thought processes moving like half-frozen mud, her stomach jumping with nausea. Her head ached with a blinding pain. Not too long ago, a blunt trauma to her skull had put her in a coma for several days and severely affected her short-term memory. Since then, she had harbored a fear of suffering a similar injury that would result in permanent mental impairment. The dull realization she was physically sound finally occurred to her. She accepted the miracle grimly because she had no idea of where she was being kept prisoner or even why. At first, Bridget could only make out very little of her surroundings. All was gloomy and dim, with little more than monstrously elongated shadows shifting over roughly hewed rock walls. She heard only whispering echoes of a sibilant language. She smelled mildew and stagnant water. After a little while, objects, sounds, and actions assumed proper proportions to reality. She made out hooded figures moving to and fro within a stone gallery, firelight glistening from damp, mossy walls. The language the figures spoke was Khmer, a sample of which she had briefly listened to in Cerberus before embarking on the interphase transit. She assumed she was within a temple, perhaps one similar to that she, Nora, and Filboid had phased into. Bridget had no difficulty recalling the few minutes preceding the attack and her abduction. Followed by Nora and Filboid, she had carried the interphaser into the Cerberus Mattrans unit. The shape of the interphaser resembled a very squat, broad-based pyramid made of smooth, gleaming alloy. Only 1 foot in overall height, its width did not exceed 10 inches. From the base protruded a small power unit and a keypad. Filboid had commented again, in his wry way, how closely the pyramidion reminded him of incense burners that could be purchased in head shops during the 1960s and 70s. Inasmuch as he had helped construct the latest version of the device, Bridget didn't take his slightly dismissive comments seriously. Filboid understood how the interphaser's pyramidal configuration was neither arbitrary nor aesthetic. The energy generated by the device progressed by 4 different routes, rejoining in a single point at the apex. The energy output flowed in a helix spiral pattern with opposite but equal frequencies of wavelength and radiation. The intensity on each side of the vortex at any given point triggered the quantum induction shift by vibrational resonance. Still, Filboid had expressed doubt many times about the interphaser's ability to function, despite the fact that if it had not been for the second version of the device, he would have never been given the opportunity to help in the construction of a third. A little over 3 months before, when the Parallax Points program was being decrypted, the Cerberus personnel involved in the process were nonplussed when one set of coordinates led to a location off the planet itself, on the moon. All of them knew the stories about pre-dark space settlements, even of secret bases on the moon, one of the largest built in the Minetius crater region. That particular site was chosen because of its proximity to artifacts that some scientists speculated were the shattered remains of an incredibly ancient city, once protected by massive geodesic domes. A remote probe had been dispatched first, and it returned not just with evidence the Minetius moon colony was still inhabited, but populated by a disaffected group of scientists, marauding packs of Carnobots, and both a flesh-and-blood devil and a machine known by the acronym of Devil. Brewster Filboid and Nora Pennick were two of the scientists living there who had agreed to relocate to Earth. Bridget found something very appealing about the lanky, myopic astrophysicist. Whether it was his self-deprecating sense of humor or his intellect, she wasn't sure. He wasn't a man of action, but he wasn't a coward either. Both of them had faced Enki, the last of the legendary Dragon Kings, in his lunar citadel. Filboid's courage, although it had cracked, hadn't completely crumbled, and Bridget had been glad to have a solid bulwark at her side on that terrifying night. The downside of that event was how Filboid began looking to Bridget as something of an anchor in his new life in Cerberus. He had insisted on accompanying her and Nora on the new interphaser's inaugural transit, and Bridget figured the prospect of losing her due to the malfunction of a machine he had helped to build awakened an almost childlike insecurity within him. Bridget didn't know Nora Pennick particularly well, since she was a quiet young woman with a reserve Bridget attributed to her calm and collected British upbringing. She and another Briton, Cleve Randolph, had been part of the Devil scientific staff on the moon. Cleve, however, had been killed when he helped Grant steal a transatmospheric Mantis ship. Unlike some of her colleagues, Nora didn't display a thinly veiled attitude of superiority toward her hosts. Many of the moonbase personnel seemed amused by the Cerberus exile's ignorance of a number of 20th-century events and items, but she wasn't one of them, and Bridget readily accepted her offer to accompany her on the test phase. After a little argument, Bridget agreed that Filboid could join her and Nora. The mission was not to launch an exploration, but simply intended to test the interphaser's capabilities, to make sure it could correctly process the parallax points data. They would make the phase transit, ascertain they had arrived where they were supposed to, and then phase back to Cerberus. Bridget anticipated the entire journey would take only a few minutes. However, as a veteran of a number of past missions that went awry, she carried a pack containing MREs, bottled water, first aid supplies, and her TP-9 auto pistol. Bridget carried the interphaser into the gateway unit and placed it on the center of the floor. When making phase transits from the redoubt, they always used the MATTRANS chamber because it could be hermetically sealed. Phil Boyd pulled the brown-tinted armaglass door closed on its counterbalanced hinges. Bridget knelt and touched the interphaser's inset activation toggles on the keyboard. She slid it back into the base as a waxy, glowing funnel of light fanned up from the metal apex of the pyramidion. It looked like a diffused veil of backlit fog with tiny shimmering stars dancing within it. Phil Boyd and Nora stared at the display in wonder. The light expanded into a gushing borealis several feet wide, spreading out within the chamber. A thready pulse of vibration tickled their skin, and shadows crawled over the armaglass walls, moving in fitful jerks and leaps. A faint hint of a breeze brushed their faces and ruffled their hair. The veil of light produced from the apex of the pyramidion extended up and outward in a wavering arc, giving the illusion of a Chinese hand fan opening up, with the interphaser acting as the handle. Both Nora and Phil Boyd had been briefed on the phenomenon, but they didn't move until Bridget stepped toward the pyramid, strolled through the fan of light, and vanished. Unlike a MATTRANS gateway jump, phasing along a hyperdimensional conduit was more akin to stepping from one room into another, if the rooms were thousands of miles apart. The phase jumper experienced a giddy second of acceleration, a half-second of whirling vertigo as if hurled a vast distance at a blinding speed, then a strange cushioning sensation as if he or she had jumped into a wall of compressed air. Upon arriving at the destination point, the period of disorientation was short, despite the fact that Phil Boyd stumbled and nearly fell. The lanky astrophysicist looked around dazedly, but he recovered quickly. The three people from Cerberus stood within an enclosure of green-black walls, two of them crumbling due to the pressure exerted by enormous tree roots. They waited until the field effect generated by the interphaser collapsed before they cautiously moved out of the building in order to take a sextant reading and ascertain they were where the parallax point's coordinates indicated they would be. Bridget estimated that was at least 3 days ago. 3 days of no word regarding the fates of Nora Pennick and Brewster Philboyd. No word of why she was being held prisoner or of what had happened to the interphaser, and certainly no word of a rescue mounted by Kane or anyone else from Cerberus. The contact was still secured to her mastoid bone, hidden by the fall of her hair. She couldn't be certain that it hadn't been damaged, and even now Kane was somewhere in Cambodia trying to hail her on it. But then again, she couldn't be certain Kane, Grant, and Domi weren't still engaged in the op to Minnesota. Regardless, she felt that Kane was already somewhere nearby, even though she had no way of knowing if her feelings stemmed from wishful thinking or a far deeper response. The head ruled the body. Cerebration came before emotions. But Bridget always shied away from examining the bond between herself and Kane. Logically, there was no explanation. They were bound by spiritual chains, linked to each other and the same destiny. Resolutely, she pushed the conjectures away. What mattered most now was surviving until Kane and most likely Grant arrived. She knew they would, because entertaining any other alternative was intolerable. It wasn't as if Bridget was frightened by the prospect of being held prisoner. Over the past 2 years, she had come to accept risk as a part of her way of life, taking chances so that others might find the ground beneath their feet a little more secure. She didn't consider her attitude idealism, but simple pragmatism. If she had learned anything from her association with Kane, Grant, and Domi, it was to regard death as a part of the challenge of existence, a fact that every man and woman had to face eventually. She would accept it without humiliating herself if it came as a result of her efforts to remove the yokes of the baronies from the collective necks of humanity. She never spoke of it, certainly not to the cynical Kane, but she had privately vowed to make the future a better, cleaner place than either the past or the present. Dourly, she reflected, it was probably a good thing she had never mentioned her goals to Kane, since he would have no doubt asked how she intended to achieve them by being captured and held in a stinking cell.